Hey there, Dragonfly Nation. This is the Canadian Bushcraft Podcast, episode 107. This episode is a follow-up to our early August of 2021 episode, Tools of the Trade. That one focused on our bushcraft tools of the trade, mostly focusing on the four-tool philosophy. But this episode is about tools of the trade for homesteading. So whether you're an urban gardener in downtown Toronto or downtown New York, or you're off-grid, off in the boonies somewhere, trying to make out a living out there in the wilderness, this episode is for you, so stay tuned. Hey there, Dragonfly Nation. I wanted to announce a very big event happening in the summer of 2022. I want to give you this information now in the wintertime so that you have time to prepare for this, because this is a big deal. The 2022 Global Bushcraft Symposium has been announced. It is going to be happening from July 27th to the 31st of July in the year 2022. It is being co-chaired by Lisa Fenton and Paul Kirtley, names that you should be well aware of, folks, especially if you're all into the bushcraft world. Speakers are including Dr. Teresa Camper, Bruce Zawalski, Gordon Dedman, Patrick McGlinchey, and Rupert Brown. These and many others are why I'm excited. These are some of the greatest brains of today when it comes down to woodcraft, survival, indigenous ancestral skills, anything you can think of in the realm of bushcraft. It is happening at this event. And it's happening in Wales, United Kingdom, in July 27th to the 31st in the year 2022. So pack your stuff up now, get it all ready, get your passport in order, get all the stuff you need in order, because this is going to be a very big event, very, very big event that I am excited to be going to with Rye the Adventure Guy. We may even record a few podcasts with some folks while we're there. Hope to see you there this coming summer from July 27th to July 31st. If you want to learn more, go to www.globalbushcraftsymposium2022.com. Again, www.globalbushcraftsymposium2022.com.
To know the landscape is to open up a door, to feel deeper connected than you've ever felt before. We know that you will love this podcast. So shut your mouth and listen to Canadian Bushcraft.
Hey there, folks. So just like our introduction explained, this episode is all about homesteading tools of the trade. This can be a little series I want to do on the show. Since looking back at our podcast, we did a really, really good one on tools of the trade for bushcraft, focusing on the four-tool philosophy and a few extra tools you may want to look at. And of course, if you go way back to the beginning of the podcast, we had one whole episode on knives, one whole episode on axes. And over the years, me and Rye and other guests have talked about specific tools that we really like to have. And with all the homesteading episodes we've done over the last year, year and a half, I figured, you know what, let's talk about the tools that I really think are important to talk about regarding homesteading. So if you're out on the land growing a small quarter acre homestead, like what we're doing, a quarter acre garden with a little bit of maybe some livestock of some sort, but mostly plants, herbs, crops of some sort, look at our previous episode to understand different kind of crops and perspectives and philosophies on crops. Or, you know, you're doing a whole farm, whether you're doing a massive farm that's several hundred acres or thousands of acre ranch, or you're doing a small backyard garden. These are tools that can be very beneficial to you. We're going to start off with really simple ones and work our way up to the more complex ones in different categories. So those categories are cutting, digging, moving, and irrigation. Those are the four main categories we want to kind of cover in this episode. And each category has a bunch of different tools, ranging from very simple hand tools up to some mechanical advantage kind of tools that you can have. So here we go. All right. So in the cutting category, we've got a few tools that we've already talked about in previous episodes, the axe and the machete. Axes go hand in hand with almost every environment. I've seen axes being used here in Ontario, up in the northern bush, even up in the Arctic. I've seen axes being used in Colombia. I've seen axes used all over the United States for everything from trail clearing and road clearing to chopping firewood to pounding in stakes and driving in rebar and all that kind of stuff. I'm not going to dive too deep into this. We've covered axes a bunch of times. I don't want to beat a dead horse. but it has to be mentioned. Axes are critical on any setup, whether it's a small homestead or a large homestead. If you're doing a lot of lopping and removing your own trees and clearing your own land, you're going to want to have an axe around, whether that's just to pound the wedges in or free a chainsaw or what have you. Axes are very, very, very beneficial. And if you're new to axes, as we said before, the bigger the axe, the safer it is, and also the easier it is to use within reason. Too big can sometimes happen if you're in small quarters or in small space. And so be thoughtful. The axe that you take out in the bush most likely will be the axe you can use around your homestead. I like a large felling axe that's got about a 32 to 36 inch handle, 3.5 to 4 pound head, even heavier if possible. And keep it sharp, keep it wickedly sharp. And before we go any deeper into this episode, pack a first aid kit. I've said this a dozen times on the show before, no matter where you're working, whether it's, you know, the back 20, the back 40, the back country, the backyard, have a first aid kit available. It may just be small cuts and scrapes. It may be a couple of burns from doing, maybe making your own biochar or burning some brush, or it could be something really severe like a broken hand or a broken arm or leg. So have a well-stocked first aid kit and know how to use it before we go any further. Second tool, I've talked about it before. Joe has talked about it as a guest on the podcast. I've talked about them many times and my love for them, machetes. Machetes, whether it's a parang, a kukri, a bolo, a Latin-style machete, a panga-style machete, whatever style you prefer, whatever you have. I usually err on the side of a shorter machete, like an 18-inch or shorter. You know, 14 to 18 is about a good length for the average person because you want to have a lot of control on that tool because it is a long cutting edge. It is one of the most dangerous non-powered tools we can have in our hands because it could be the same length as your axe, but 90% of it is a cutting edge. So we got to keep that in mind that a shorter machete is going to be much more useful for someone who is not accustomed to using them. You're going to have a lot more control in them and there's a lot less of a chance of getting cut by them. At that point, though, my favorite machete is almost 30 inches long. That is my preferred machete for working around the garden, working around the homestead. The machete I take camping with me, completely different. It's like 17, 18 inches long, maximum in the blade length. So it really does come down to what you're doing. If you're on a homestead, a large plantation style machete, maybe a heavier blade, longer blade, will help you clear 1-2 inch thick saplings, cut out vines, chop up brush, mulch the ground, whatever you got to do. And it's also going to save your back because you're not going to have to stoop as much. When we're doing bushcraft with a machete, we're often doing it on our standing feet, or maybe we'll crouch down and we're doing small tasks. We're clearing a few things out of the way so we can get our hammock set up. We're chopping back a few different things, or we're gathering a little bit of material like cattail or grass. When we're doing homestead chores, we're working near the ground a lot. We're going to be removing buckthorn and dog strangling vine and creeping Charlie and grass. And all that stooping can start to put a number on your back. And remember, when you're working in the garden, you're working on a homestead, you're going to be stressing your back a lot. You're going to be, you know, tilling the ground. You're going to be, if you do, depending on the type of tilling we're talking about here, it could be everything from broad forking or just kind of using a hula hoe or a stirrup hoe, raking. But it could be as far as, you know, planting your garden, you know, weeding the garden, tending to certain plants, removing bugs off certain plants. I'm fighting with cucumber beetles still. They're attacking my cucamelons now. I got them off the squash finally, but now they're going after the cucamelons. So all that stooping can start to put a number on your back. And if I have to do a lot of stooping to clear the brush, and then I got to do a lot more stooping doing the garden, I'm going to be miserable. So the longer the blade, the less I have to stoop, the more I can let my hands do the work and the blade do the work and less of my back. My good friend Ben, he's a chainsaw operator. He's a sawyer. He works in arborist work and he worked as a wildland firefighter for, I think, 6 or 7 years. And we've had that talk that usually, yeah, light, short chainsaw is amazing. That is the best chainsaw to use for a lot of the felling work you're going to be doing. That's going to be great for doing a lot of the dropping and bucking kind of stuff. And we'll talk about that in a moment. But then he brings up, yeah, sometimes you want to have that long chainsaw blade so you don't have to bend over all day. And that's really where I think the same philosophy can go into our machetes. So if you have the option of having more than one machete in your collection, have one that's long for the garden and the homestead, maybe a heavier blade, and one that's light that you take camping with you. After those two main tools for cutting, I think the real tools that most people are going to be using are things like loppers and pruners. So a pruner or pruning shears are one-hand operation, loppers are two-hand operation. I like the through-cut style, not the anvil style. So what we're talking about there is it's going to be like a pair of pliers or a pair of scissors. You have one jaw and another jaw. One is usually sharpened and the other isn't. Sometimes it's what's called pass-through, which means they kind of go past each other like a pair of scissors or shears. And the other style are the anvil style where the cutting edge pushes into something that's a slightly softer steel or maybe brass. And that gives you kind of a cutting point or a pressure point to really focus your energy and cut. I'm not a big fan of that style because they often have a lot less leverage. They don't feel as comfortable to use, in my opinion. And there's some that have like ratcheting systems and stuff. It's great. I'm a keep it simple, stupid kind of philosophy person. So I don't like to have a bunch of moving parts on my tools unless they have to have a bunch of moving parts. And that's our motorized tools or power tools. I like the simplest tool possible. So when it comes down to my loppers, I have a pass-through lopper that has a couple of gears on it, but they're not like a ratcheting system with a bunch of moving parts. They're just attached to the limbs of the tool. Mine are Fiskars. I think they're the Power Gear 2 or something like that. I never really looked hard at them. All I know is I've cut 3-inch buckthorn with those things, and they only take the occasional sharpening. And when I mean occasional, it's whenever I notice they get dull. So like maybe after a month or month and a half of work, I'm like, man, these things have gotten dull. And then I'll take a file to them, sharpen them back up. We're back in action. Loppers are my preference when it comes down to working in the garden, in the homestead, clearing stuff. Machetes are great, but you got to swing them. And if I don't have to swing, there's a less chance of me getting cutting somebody else or tiring myself out. Or cutting the wrong thing, especially when you have a lot of trees you're trying to grow with. I have apple trees, I have pear trees, I have quince trees, I have, you know, all these beautiful trees that we've talked about before, elderberries, and now I have vines growing into them. I've got West Indian gherkin, which is an invasive non-native plant here. I have wild grape, I've got dog strangling vine, I've got poison ivy, I've got raspberry bushes that I've got to clear back. And if I use a machete, you know, it becomes one of those, if all you got is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. I end up potentially limbing my trees that I want to keep, or even, God help me, chopping them down. So loppers can let me be a lot more precise and a little bit more forward thinking of what's happening in that area. Pruning shears, again, they're just like the one hand version of a pair of loppers. Again, mine are a pair of Fiskars. I'm not overly impressed with these ones. I like the loppers. I'm not impressed with the pruning shears. A lot of people have different options. I'm not going to tell you which ones to buy, but again, I prefer the through cut method or the pass through chopping or cutting method instead of an anvil and blade method style. They work fine. You may even want a pair of pruning scissors. If you're going after herbs or you're doing soft material cutting to control the growth of certain plants or control the certain growth of certain trees, they're great as well. I've got a couple of different pairs of those, and there's a lot of different brands out there that are good. Again, I'm not going to tell you which ones to carry. Those are pretty much the main cutting tools I use on the homestead, but there's a few others. I don't use these, but some people do. Scythes. A scythe or a sickle, the hand style, hand size or one hand style, and the scythe being the two hand style. Ben Bouchard, who was on the podcast back in the winter, is a great source of information and sells them on the Baryonyx Knife Co. website. I don't use scythes very often because I just don't need them. I want one. I want to use them. I've got an old brush scythe blade that belonged to my father, but the snathe or handle has been long gone. And they're great. They're great tools. They work very much like a non-motorized weed whacker in the sense of you start at your right and you move to your left with it. And as you move, it slices through. And if you keep it with the right kind of edge, which is more toothy than a knife edge, a lot of people get them a little too sharp and they actually have problems gripping and tearing into the grass or into the weeds that they're cutting. And then you got different kinds of blades for different kinds of conditions. You can, with a scythe, effectively go up, depending on the type of blade, up to 1 inch thick woody material. So they're not just for cutting lawns. They're not just for cutting hay and straw. They can be used for quite a different variety of terrain on your homestead. So do not think that they are just an old tool that you expect to see amongst some Mennonites or Amish folk. They are something that is very viable on your property, especially when you run out of gas, can't afford to get gas, don't have the ability to maintain the tool that's a power tool, like a brush cutter or weed whacker. They are a great backup tool in that sense. And they're actually a really good, calm, low impact exercise. When you get into the groove of it, it's very fast, it's very simple, and it's actually quite enjoyable. I've enjoyed using scythes over the years, and I can't wait to get my own when my finances are right, or if I find a good one in an antique store that I can tune up to fit my size and stature. Now, other kinds of cutting tools you may want to have in your shed, in your toolbox, wire cutters. Across the board, wire cutters. You're going to want to have them. They can be the classic snips that you see in your classic like hardware store toolkit of like different types of pliers. It could be just a pair of pliers. It could be your Leatherman Wave or Leatherman whatever. You're going to want wire cutters. Whether it's for cattle fence trellising, wiring things together, putting together fencing for your livestock, whatever, you're going to want to have wire cutters. And you know what? Spend the money. I'm always for trying to go cheap, and I'm always trying to go for, when I say cheap, I'm talking about like financially wise with your purchases, and like you don't have to always get the most expensive thing in the toolkit. You know, like a $5 screwdriver will be just as good as a $3 screwdriver. There's a $2 difference. Go with the $3 screwdriver. You're not going to cry that much about it. With wire cutters, I always recommend going for like the Nipex or other good brand, like $30, $40 wire cutters, or again, really good quality Leathermans or multi-tools, because going through wire, especially thicker, stiffer wire like cattle fence, no, you're going to want to have the wire cutters that are good priced. They are across the board. There's also like fencing tools, which are a great option. They have different kinds of size wire cutters on them. They have the little hammerhead. They've got the prying tool. They've got the actual pliers set into them, and even these special little grooves set for using U-shaped staples, like the big fencing staples. Those are great. I love having a pair of fencing tools in my toolkit. That's a great option. And so, yeah, those are your hand-tooled or non-powered cutters. Your motorized cutters or power tools are chainsaws, lawnmowers, chippers, weed whackers, or brush cutters. So let's start with chainsaws. A 16-inch, whether it's a Husqvarna or it is a Still or it is a Johnson Red, you're going to be pretty happy with them. A 16 to 18-inch will be just fine for the majority of people and the majority of tasks that you're going to be going up against or chores. A 22-inch bar, 24-inch bar, they're great. If you want to get into things like milling lumber, your own lumber and stuff, and being a little bit more self-reliant, sure, go for a bigger chainsaw as well. But we go back to that metaphor I was talking about earlier, which was an analogy for the machete, but is specifically talking about chainsaws. A shorter, lighter chainsaw, you can carry it a lot longer, do a lot more tasks with it. It's a lot more nimble, it's a lot more agile, and it's a lot easier to control. A big chainsaw requires more fuel, it requires more muscle, and it requires a much stronger back or a lot more resilient back and legs. I'm very happy with my Still. I think it's a 291. Currently has a 16-inch bar and 16-inch chain. I would love to move back up to an 18 or 20-inch bar personally on that saw, but 16 has been doing everything I need this year, including cutting all of my firewood for the sugar bush and beyond. It's a very good size chain, it's a chain and bar. I'm not a big fan of the Poland brand. I know a lot of people like them, and a lot of people who are a lot more mechanically savvy than me enjoy them because they can do all their own maintenance on them and all that kind of stuff. I follow the philosophy that if it's a pull-in chainsaw, you're going to be pulling on it all day long. Every pull-in chainsaw I've used has driven me up the damn wall. I can't stand them. but that's my own personal experience. I have a bunch of cousins and a bunch of buddies who use Poland chainsaws, and they are very happy with them. I like my Still. Other people like their Husqvarnas. You know what? Ford versus Chevy, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. If it's a chainsaw that works well for you, use it. Don't get sucked up into the brand name arguments. Stills are good. Husqvarnas are good. Johnson Reds are good. Polands are good, according to people that like Polands. On that note, though, there's fuel questions. And this can go with all the rest of the tools we're going to be talking here, except for the chipper. Electric chainsaws have gone leaps and bounds further than where they were 5 years ago. The battery-powered Stills, the battery-powered Husqvarnas can do the majority of tasks. And I do truly mean the majority of tasks the average homesteader is going to be facing. It's when you get into heavy arborist work, forester work, sawyer work, where you may not want to have that. But if you're cutting fence posts, you're clearing some brush off a trail, clearing a tree that came down, cutting up a little bit of firewood, the battery-powered Husqvarnas and the battery-powered Stills, I've had a lot of good success with them. I've played with them a few times now. I really dig them. Their battery life is pretty good. And of course, they're rechargeable. So if you're living on solar or you're living on the grid, they are going to be rechargeable. And that is a lot more affordable than constantly having to buy more gas. That's my water bottle. It likes to make weird glugging sounds when I drink out of it, even when I try to sit quietly. The other benefits of an electric chainsaw versus a gas-powered chainsaw is that they're quiet-er. They still make some noise, but they're not loud. You don't always have to be wearing hearing protection with them. You still want to be wearing all other types of protection. Gloves, chainsaw chaps, face mask, all that kind of stuff. But the beauty to me is if I have a couple people working together in the brush and we're clearing stuff, I can hear them when they say, whoa, 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 or hey, hold up. I can turn off the chainsaw immediately. I don't have to take off my headphones and try to hear them better while I, you know, turn off the saw slowly and still make some noise for a couple of seconds. I can hear them while I'm working and I can be like, what? Oh, yeah, no problem. I'll cut over here and I can keep doing my job. The other benefit is as soon as you take your finger off the trigger, the chainsaw stops running. So when it comes down to safety, I find them safer. They also have better torque in general because they're electric. And this is what people like to argue about, electric versus gas. Electric motors have more torque. They do. Look it up, research it, Google it yourself. I'm not going to try and argue you. Google it. Electric has more torque than gas. It just does. That's why electric Mack trucks are getting onto the market in the next couple of years. There's the Tesla motors, and now there's apparently Edison motors that's doing an electric diesel hybrid Mack truck or semi truck out in British Columbia. There's all these different projects going on to try and make electric big vehicles because they have better torque. They can handle more chores. They can be more efficient. So keep that in mind. When you're looking at your chainsaws, keep that in mind. And they're not any more expensive than a gas-powered. In fact, some models are cheaper than their gas-powered counterparts. So there's always that option. Beyond chainsaws, lawnmowers. Lawnmowers, two-stroke, electric, whatever you want to go with. I have no brand loyalty on this. I've used a bunch of different lawnmowers from a bunch of different brands. I've used electric. I've used the Ryobi style ones. I've used the push that are hand powered or foot powered. I've used the gas powered. They all do the same thing. They cut weeds, they cut grass, they trim everything down to a short area. You can mulch with them. So if you have big piles of brush, that are certain size. You don't want to be going after, you know, 1-inch, 2-inch thick sticks. But if you have a bunch of little twigs, a bunch of leaf litter, leaf mold, or you have a bunch of straw, and you got to make a better mulch for your compost, you got to chop it up for a good mulch over your garden beds, you can make a pile and just run over it a couple of times with the lawnmower, and that'll work very well. So lawnmower is a great thing to have around, whether it's gas-powered, electric, whatever. It's your choice, dealer's choice. Figure out what you like and what you can afford. Again, keep up on them, keep them sharp, oil them, maintain them, all these kind of tools you got to do a lot of maintenance on. Get tech savvy, get mechanically savvy with these things so you can do your own maintenance. I haven't yet. I've taken apart a couple of chainsaws and I hate it every time because I feel like I'm going to break something or I feel like I'm going to lose a part. My cousin does a lot of the maintenance for me on my power tools because he knows what he's doing. He basically rebuilt my lawnmower last year under a tree in the shade of my yard. It was amazing to help him out and watch him work. And I learned quite a few things during that. But it was just great to have someone that knows what they're doing. So if you do not have a mechanically inclined mind, find friends that are mechanically inclined. You don't always have to go back to the shop and get their mechanic to do stuff and cost you an arm and a leg. If you've got a good neighbor, a good friend, a cousin, a sibling, you know, make a deal with them and they can take care of those parts for you and they can handle that stuff for you and figure it out. If it does cost you some money, it'll save you some at least because they can do a lot of that work for you. Just buy the parts. Chippers, whether it's a big chipper or a lawn chipper or what's called a garden chipper, these things are amazing. You can make your own mulch. You can deal with all that extra brush you always having. When me and Ryan, well, the first year that I cleared the land for my homestead, from April until June of the pandemic, we were not allowed to have any guests on the res. We weren't allowed to have any visitors. And so I had to clear the land myself, and I had a lot of brush piles. And a lot of those I converted into biochar, but I always had more brush piles. And luckily when Rye and other friends were able to come back into the community and help out, we did a lot of burning. And as I worked on the garden, I kept going like, man, if only I had some sort of chipper available that I could have mulched that all up with and done that for the garden. And then the next year I came across the company through the app Chip Drop. And I organized a wood chip drop off from arborists. And this is something everyone should be doing if they're looking for mulch, is make friends with arborists. They are always looking for places to get rid of their wood chips. Take it every time. Take it. Any wood chip you can get. Softwood, hardwood. Hardwood is better for the most part, but softwood has its own benefits, especially if you're growing things that are used to acidic soils like blueberries. You can throw a bunch of white pine or spruce wood chips around them, and they're going to do just fine. But hardwood wood chips are what you're looking for if you want to grow mushrooms, if you want to grow around hardwood trees and all that kind of stuff. You want hardwood chips. You can buy a wood chipper, put all your brush through it, and there's your wood chips for the year. And you can throw all your lawn clippings through it. You can throw all your leaf waste, your leaf mold, the dropping of the leaves every fall, and turn that all into really good compost, mulch material for your gardens, to build up your no-till garden beds, or just build up soil and soil health and mycelial structure. It doesn't have to be necessarily mycorrhizae in your soil so that you have a good fungal bacterial network growing between your perennial plants and your annual plants and your other soils and everything else. After a lot of work with arborists and a lot of work with people who do forestry and a lot of people who do lawn work and lawn care, the one piece of wisdom I've learned over the years is do not buy a chipper. Rent them. Yes, they can cost a lot of money, but you do not have to deal with any of the maintenance headaches that come along with owning a chipper. This is not something I'm joking about. This is a legit thing. How much maintenance goes into taking care of a machine that people are force feeding hardwood pieces of buckthorn and cedar and spruce and willow and fibrous woods like locust and stuff. You feed a bunch of that through a chipper and there might be some nails in some of those branches. There might be some wire in a branch or two that you didn't see. And that goes into that chipper. To be frank, that's part of the cost of renting a chipper, but you don't have to deal with the maintenance yourself. Every person I've talked to is like, no, rent them. And I've rented a chipper on two separate occasions for two separate property projects. And it was amazing how much we could get done in a weekend. And that's the thing, is you rent one for a weekend and you basically save up all your brush pilings and your clippings and your trees, small trees, depending on the size of them. Anything bigger than like 4 or 5 inches, I wouldn't say even more than 3 inches, you don't really want to put through a chipper if you don't have to. That can all go towards firewood and fence posts and building material and all that stuff. But all the branches and things that are 2 inches in diameter and smaller, 3 inches in diameter and smaller, throw it in the throw it in the chipper, do it for a whole weekend, and then you're done with it. You're done with it. Don't have to worry about it. Don't have to think about it. You paid the $400 or $500, sometimes $600. It's getting more and more expensive every year. You paid for the fuel and you're done. You don't have to think about that machine ever again. You send it back and you're done. I'm not saying abuse the chipper, but this way you don't have to deal with all the headaches of, hey, we're going to store this damn monstrosity when you don't have to use it. What are you going to do to take care of it all the time? Or how are you going to maintain it, winterize it, all that kind of stuff? There's very few properties where you need more than one or two weekends of chipping. If you plan it out and get your piles made, your slash piles and stuff, you can do some that are converted into biochar, whether you do with an open pit like I do, or you do it with a wood stove or a chimney or a closed fireplace. And convert that all to ash and charcoal that you can use for your gardens. And then other piles, you're like, nope, we're going to chip that to its good quality poplar and good quality maple and good quality ash. We're going to turn that all into good wood chip mulch for the garden. And then you rent the chipper, get a couple of friends over with a case of beer, pull out the barbecue, and just chip, 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 chip all day long. Have a good barbecue dinner of ribs and steak and whatnot. And then the next day, a chip, 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 a couple of beers afterwards, and you're done. Take it back to the shop that you rented it from, and you're done. You are done. Do not buy a chipper, rent a chipper. Simple as that. Simple as that. Or do what I do. Turn most of it into biochar and just get people to drop off wood chip for you. The final main cutting tool I want to talk about is a wire cutter. A brush cutter. I was trying to think about the term for the cable that comes up, but basically a weed whacker. You want to get a pretty robust one because you're not going to be doing just dandelions and thistle with it. You're going to want to take out things like nettle. You're going to want to be able to take out things, which not all the time. I like having my nettles around. I use them as a green. I gather them for fiber, all that kind of stuff. But sometimes they're just in the wrong place. You got to clean up the edges of your garden beds. You got to remove weeds. You got to do this or that. Clean up your ditch. Make sure your neighbors aren't complaining. All that kind of stuff. A good weed whacker. It doesn't have to be the brand weed whacker. Mine's a Still. Most of my power tools are Still, or motorized tools are Stills. Just because I go to the same shop for all of them. Why not? Because then I can just get one person to maintain them and take care of them. And I don't have to use one kind of fuel and all that kind of stuff. Husqvarna makes great ones. There's a few different good brands out there. And again, electric versus gas. I haven't seen a lot saying anything bad about the electric ones. I'm not opposed to them. I like my gas powered one because it's got some good power, but again, torque is relative. Electric has more torque. But yeah, you want to get the heaviest duty cable you can use to cut with, cable cutting. If you look at different brands like Husqvarna and stuff, they have all these new gadgets that you can be put on the power head of your tool to do different kinds of things in different kinds of environments. There's even saw blades if you've got the two-hand style weed whacker or cutter, brush cutter. There's the two-hand style that you can put a saw blade on to cut up to like 1.5-inch small trees. So you can actually like do brush clearing with your tool, which is amazing. So those are your main cutting tools that you would want to be considering at least on your homestead. Let's dive into digging. On the subject of digging tools, most people are going to think of shovels. And we're going to talk about shovels, but I think the first tool we should talk about is a digging bar / pry bar / tamping tool. A good 5-6 foot digging bar is worth its weight in gold. And you can buy them from most hardware stores. There's some that are brand name and stuff. I've never really seen the brand on them. I'm sure a bunch of different companies make them. The chisel pointed heavy square bar that has a rounded handle up near where your hands are going to be, and down near the bottom, down near the tip, it's going to be more squared off. Those are really good for being able to pop rocks out of the ground, dig posts, pound away at stuff, break rock even if you need to, break up soil, all that kind of stuff. And then I've got a longer round bar that I forged myself out of an old weightlifting lifting bar. And that's a good steel. It's going to take a lot of torque. It's going to take a lot of abuse. And so I just forged the end. One friend moving the steel while I swung a sledgehammer, got it red hot, and formed it into a square point, and then rounded off into an octagonal point, and then ground it smooth into a round point. And that thing is a javelin. That thing goes so deep in the ground. So if I have to put like trellising up or put up like an arch frame of some sort for like a geodesic trellis or something, or we're building a new structure, that's the one I use to break through the clay and bust through the ground and put like a 2 foot down, a deep hole down into that ground. And we like, we've talked about this on the podcast before. My ground here is hard packed, compressed clay. And the fact that this can go 2 feet down with one throw, that is great. If you can have a welded flat or round plate on the other side to be a tamping bar to pack dirt down around plants, around fence posts and stuff, even better. That's a great option as well. Digging bars, I love them. I have moved stumps out of the ground with them. I have moved rocks and boulders out of the ground. I've broken up concrete that people pour to the wrong place with them. I have moved logs and trees with them. It's a giant lever or lever, however you want to pronounce it. It's leverage 100% of the way. It is a great tool to have in your toolkit, a great tool to have on the homestead. They are so amazing. And with that said and done, let's talk about shovels. Square-headed shovels and rounder or pointed spades, those are the two major categories of shovels that people know. I like to have a mix of two or three, four, if I can, types of shovels on hand. Shovels are just, they're so great. They can move stuff. They can dig. They can break up soil. They can, you know, plant your rose bush, plant your apple trees, dig up the ground and move it around, throw it for you. It's a lever. You can pry with them a little bit, not like your digging bar. If you got to really push at a big rock, go get your digging bar. Don't waste your shovel on it. Working in archaeology for like 12 years onward, I have a love and affinity for different styles of shovels. They are so beneficial. To start with, get yourself a long-handled spade, that classic shovel that almost every person sees in their grandpa's garden, the grandma's garden shed or the grandpa's garage. Get one of those with a good solid head and a good solid throat or ferrule on it, so it's not going to break off on you or delaminate. And you want to have a good solid handle and maintain that handle as best you can, but accept the fact that it's probably going to break. Even the fiberglass ones, especially the fiberglass ones. Wooden shovel handles are easier to replace, just like an axe handle, just like any other kind of tool handle. I recommend wood because, yeah, they break, but they're easy to replace. They're cheap and you can do it yourself. It's not hard. You get a fiberglass shovel handle breaking, it's a little bit more work. And then with that, get yourself a square shovel or squared off a rectangular shaped shovel with a short handle that's got a D grip on it. That's going to be your main driving it into the ground and stomping on it and levering back to pop out like burdock roots that are growing into your garden bed or making a perfect hole. I like to put square holes in the ground to plant my trees because it doesn't allow as much root binding to happen. They're going to hit that corner, that facet, and be like, okay, that's the direction I have to go. You make a round pit and the roots can start to actually spiral around and around and around, not really do well for the tree. So a nice square shovel. It also allows you to dig a flat bottom. So if you have to do trenching, you're finishing off the bottom of a pond for your ducks, like I had to do a couple summers back or last summer, what have you, whatever it may be, a square shovel that's got a short handle with a D grip on it and a longer spade are a good combo for most tasks. They're going to handle the majority of the digging issues you may come across. Beyond those digging tools, there are other digging tools. We have hoes and mattocks. Hoes are a pulling tool that you can drive into the ground, and they're there's a lot of different styles of them. There's the grubbing hoes. There's the garden classic hoe, which has got like a squared off or rectangular shaped head. That is used for just moving dirt and tilling up some soil lightly around your carrots and potatoes and things like that. They're good for like mounding up dirt around your potatoes. That's like my favorite thing about them, is just to move dirt up around potatoes and around carrots and things like that. They're also good for breaking up soil that is already light and soft. Do not try this on hard packed clay. I'm telling you, that's where grubbing hoes come into hand. Grubbing hoes are very solid, stout, often sharp pointed, or like designed like a big adze to just beat the crap out of the ground and just chop it up and trench it out and do whatever you need to do. If you have to build irrigation, you want a grubbing hole. If you've got to dig around the foundation of your house to pour new gravel in, so you have better erosion control, you want a grubbing hoe. These are not things you want to do with a garden hoe. Grubbing hoes are great. The other type of hoe that I use a lot of, especially early in the season and late in the season, is what's called often a stirrup hoe or a hula hoe. And there's a lot of different varieties of them. There's hula hoes that are on a wheel system, so you can actually move forward with them almost like a lawnmower. And then there's the hand-powered stirrup hoes that I use, or hula hoes that I use. These are for light tilling and weeding. This is something that when you first start off your garden beds for the season, you'll have a bunch of weeds in there, you'll have a bunch of stuff coming up, and the ground will be a little compressed from the winter, from all the heavy snowfall and everything else. You take a stirrup hoe and you basically just chew away at the ground lightly, and it's going to tear up grass. It is the best way to remove crap grass, in my opinion, from your garden beds. It chops up all that mullein that pops up, all the dandelions that pop up, all that kind of stuff. You just chop it up with that, and it takes the whole very top 2 inches off your bed. And then you can sift through all that and put all the good soil back into the ground and take all those plants and put them in your compost, put them to your ducks. Don't feed mullein to your ducks. Don't feed burdock to your ducks. Dandelions, nettles, things like that can go to the ducks and chickens. But whatever it may be, that's one of the best things to use for cleaning up garden beds and starting new garden beds. When I planted my potatoes, I removed all the wood chip that I had on the ground in their area. And then I used the stirrup hoe and chewed the ground up so that the potatoes had a good start. And I added in compost and chewed that up with the ground that the native soil that was there, so that the potatoes had a good bed to start on and they could grow up into the new mulch and wood chip and straw and compost that I would throw on top of them and mound up around them. So stirrup hoes are great, and grubbing hoes are great, and garden hoes in general are great. On the subject of grubbing hoes, there's another tool, and that is a mattock. Mattocks are in the pickaxe family of tools. Pickaxes are great too. They all have like a tomahawk fit head, so they don't get wedged in like an axe. They go onto a thicker mattock handle, and then your head slides up it on a tapered shaft with a tapered eye, and they lock together with friction and pressure, and you can pretty much do some really abusive tasks with them. Because the handles are not going to break as easily because they're not pinned or riveted or anything else like that. It's just a solid piece of lumber that has the head on it, and you're using leverage. My favorite mattock style tool is what's called a cutter mattock. It has a grubbing hoe head on one side, and on the other side it has a small stout axe blade. And that's great for chopping through roots. It's great for chopping into hard soils and stuff like that to break it up, and then use that grubbing hoe edge to dig the soils. This is what I use for breaking down old compacted earth mounds that are all around the place. This is what I used for building trails at my camp, building trails here on the property, digging out our pond, pulling up stumps, all that kind of stuff. That with a digging bar can do a lot of trail maintenance and can do a lot of house maintenance, like homestead maintenance, ranch maintenance. Grubbing hoe head on one side, axe head on the other side. It's a great combination. You have a pick mattock, which has a pick head instead of a cutter head, and then you have the grubbing hoe on the other side. I prefer the cutter mattock for our soils. If you live in rockier terrain, you may want a pick mattock. It all comes down to your personal preferences. Those are our majority of our digging tools. So mattocks or pickaxes are the last part of that category. Again, digging bars, shovels, hoes, and mattocks. Those are the main ones you got to be thinking about. So we've talked about cutting, we've talked about digging, let's talk about moving. Your moving tools. These are what can be used for moving medium around, moving things around, all that kind of stuff. And again, we're going to start with our simple hand tools and work our way up to our power tools or our motorized tools. The first one on the top of the list, rakes. You knew I'm going to have to talk about them at some point, rakes. Your classic like lawn rake or leaf rake, they're great. They're useful. They have their place, little wire heads on there like a fan. They're good. There's nothing wrong with them. They're not evil. I'm not saying don't have them. Get yourself a gravel rake. Get yourself something that can move earth and move wood chip and move seaweed and straw and heavy piles of lawn clippings and compost, pushing your duck out of the way so you can get back to work, whatever it may be. A good solid gravel rake, again, with a wooden handle. That's where everything really, and there's a lot of different types of rakes, and I'm not saying that any of the other ones are crap, but start with a good gravel rake. Everyone needs a good gravel rake. Moving gravel, whatever it may be, that's the kind of tool you want to have, is a good rake. Beyond rakes, and kind of in the same category, pitchforks. Pitchforks are the tool that I think I use every time I'm in the homestead, every time I'm in the garden. When we get those piles of wood chip dropped off, shovels are good. Pitchforks are better. When I have to move straw out of the duck coop into the garden as compost or as mulch or whatever, shovels work, rakes work, pitchforks are better. When it comes down to turning compost, shovels work, rakes work, pitchforks are better. If I have to move burning material around in my burn pile for my char, for my biochar, rakes work, shovels work, digging bars work, pitchforks are better. Pitchforks are great. Long handled pitchfork that's got the long tapered pointed tines, and get yourself a shorter one with a D grip, just like our shovel talk, that has the wider, flatter tines. They're both going to be useful in the garden. They're both going to be useful. My favorite thing for using a pitchfork for, and something that I learned only about a year ago, is when you have to transplant trees. Let's say I put an apple tree in the southwest corner of my garden. And, you know, 2 years on, the tree has gotten its roots established and all that kind of stuff. And then I realized, crap, it would actually make more sense in the northwest corner, not in the southeast or southwest corner, because of where the sun's coming up and where I need to actually have some shade for the garden, and I need some shade here for the ducks. It's shading out the garden beds here, but it'll help with the ducks or the chickens up here. I could dig it out with a shovel and probably damage every single root in that tree. Or I can go up to it on four or five different angles, drive the pitchfork down at about a 45 and lift up and lift up and lift up and work my way around and damage one, maybe two roots. That tree is going to have a better chance of successfully transplanting and surviving than one that I dug with a shovel. 100%. It's something to really take into consideration of why pitchforks are like the quintessential. Like, you look at that famous painting, American Gothic, there's a pitchfork in the photo. The old, I'm not trying to, like, in any way, shape, or form support the torches and pitchforks of the old days, but there's a reason pitchforks are on that list of tools. Every farmstead had one. It's a common country folk tool that can be used for everything from working compost, working manure, to moving a snapping turtle off the road, to shoveling a road-killed raccoon into your recycling bin to go throw in the compost pile, or to take home and eat, whatever. Pitchforks are amazing tools, and you need to have at least one, if not three or five of them, in your toolkit, in your work shed, in your garden shed, what have you. There's nothing better than being able to move stuff like straw or compost with a pitchfork. It just makes more sense. Along the line of simple tools that you should have lots of, buckets. I am constantly grabbing 5-gallon pails or buckets from wherever I see them, sitting at yard sales, thrown into a ditch somewhere, sitting on a corner of a neighborhood. I will grab that 5-gallon bucket every single time. Moving compost, moving charcoal, moving duck feed or animal feed of any kind, moving plants around, moving water around, bucketing out water, mixing up compost, mixing up fertilizers, mixing up urine and things like that, storing urine. When we're charging our biochar with urine, it's in a 5-gallon bucket. When I'm storing compost to ferment it down with a bunch of lactobacilli bacterias and vinegar mothers and yeasts. I'm going to use a 5-gallon bucket with a lid. When I'm making booze, like plum wine or apple cider, hard cider specifically, I'm using a 5-gallon bucket with a lid with a fermenter bolted into it, a hole drilled into the lid and a little gasket attached, and then the fermenter airlock put on the top. 5-gallon buckets storing food in areas where you know there's mice and chipmunks, whether it's duck feed or animal medicines or your actual crop. I store flour corn, flint corn, acorn, rice, wild rice, everything in 5-gallon buckets. You can grow things in 5-gallon buckets, and then when the season's over, dump it out, fill it up with the crop that you harvest out of all those 5-gallon buckets, and seal it and store it in your house. Like buckets, just have a pile of buckets. And when I say a pile, I'm not being exaggerative. I'm not being over the top. 15, 20 5-gallon buckets with at least, you know, a quarter of them having good snap-on lids. This is not over the top at all. They stack well. They store well. Go for the most heavy-duty ones you can. Store brand like Home Depot or Lowe's do not hold up well. They usually last a year or two at most. The original filter for our duck pond was built out of 4 5-gallon buckets with a bunch of plumbing hooked into them with gaskets and stuff. So many different directions you can go with a 5-gallon bucket. They can become a seat at any time when you're working in the garden. They can become a basket to harvest things in, like carrots or apricots, whatever, and bring them into the house. They are so useful. Stockpile your buckets and have a ton of them, and have ones that are specifically set aside for certain things that are food safe, and have ones set aside that are meant for things that are not food safe. If you're into humanure composting, you probably know about the humanure cookbook, where in there they talk about the simple loo, the simple toilet, that is a wooden frame that goes over a 5-gallon bucket with some peat moss or wood chip inside of it. And then you just keep topping up whatever you deposit with a little bit more wood chip or peat moss. And then once that bucket's about 2/3 to 3/4 filled, you seal the lid and you do it again, and you do it again until you got 10 or 15 buckets. And then you put that all together with some straw, and there's your compost. And again, 5-gallon buckets. When I have to treat my ducks for bumblefoot, which is an infection of the foot, we talked about this on the duck episode. You cut a hole in the lid, you line that with either a pool noodle or insulation foam, or even just duct tape so they don't cut their neck on the edges of the hole you made, just for their head to peek out of. It doesn't have to be a very big hole, like 2 inches in diameter is fine. And then you fill it with iodine and water, or you fill it with Epsom salts and water. You put the duck into that bucket and you snap the lid on. You leave them in there for 35 minutes to an hour, pull them out, treat them, and then that's their medical quarantine for that time to remove the bumblefoot. So buckets, get them all. It's like Pokemon, catch them all. Get a bunch of Lowe's buckets, get a bunch of Home Depot buckets, TSC buckets, PV buckets. I don't know if Walmart or Home Depot have, or not Home Depot, Canadian Tire have their own brands of buckets with their logo on it. Get those ones too. Collect them all. They're like Pokemon. Buckets. I could end this moving segment right here. I've been talking about buckets for like 5 minutes straight out of a 10-minute segment. But let's move on from buckets to the bigger bucket, wheelbarrows. I'm going to tell you right now, I have used every type of wheelbarrow you can think of. They are not all equal. The simple two-armed, one-wheeled wheelbarrow trumps any fancy modern wheelbarrow you see. And I'm not talking about like little garden wagons and stuff, like the little Fisher Price ones that we all had as kids and stuff, or the little red wagons. Those are great. Those are different. They can be put in the wheelbarrow category, but they're not what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about wheelbarrows. I'm talking about two wheel, one wheel, three wheel. I've seen one wheel wins because you can move around things really easily. Once your garden is established, and let's say you have a food forest involved with a bunch of different hascap bushes and blueberry bushes and low bush blueberry, high bush blueberry, currants, elderberries, apples, pears, cherries, potato patches, sunflower patches, corn patches, Hugel culture mounds, all that kind of stuff, terra preta, all that kind of stuff set up, your garden becomes very narrow in where you can walk. Especially once the squash and cucumbers start to really explode and expand their range into your trails, you cannot use a two-wheeled wheelbarrow. It just doesn't work well. You're going to crush something. You're going to run into something. And yeah, they're more stable than a one-wheeled wheelbarrow. Learn to walk more stable, and learn to walk slow and steady. Don't walk fast. Don't try to jump over things with it. Don't try to go over big roots or big stumps. Learn to use the wheelbarrow the way it's intended and learn to just walk slow. There's nothing wrong with that. You don't have to race to the compost. You don't have to race to the duck pen. You can move the wheelbarrow at a very steady, slow pace. So wheelbarrows, keep them simple, but they're great. Let's talk about motorized. An ATV, four-wheeler, quad, whatever you want to call them, quad runners, I've heard them called, are like, and they're not useful to the backyard gardener. I'm going to make that very clear. They're not great to for urban or suburban gardeners. ATVs aren't the most useful. But when you're working on like a 1 acre, 5 acre, 20 acre, 200 acre homestead, an ATV. Hondas make great ones. I've used Yamaha since I was 14. I even still use a Yamaha that I had when I was 14. They're all great. Polaris, Can-Am. There's the side-by-side UTV style ATVs. There's the classic riding on the back four-wheeler. There's the three-wheeled Honda trikes. Those ones are a little bit more tippy, but man, are they fun. Be careful, you might get hurt on them. There's even like Rokon, who are making motorcycles that can be used on homesteads and stuff. That's a great option as well. Stick to four-wheelers, like four-wheel whenever possible, because again, they're more stable, you can carry more stuff on them, they have more power. You've got the front rack, you've got the back rack, you've got a hitch, you've got a winch if you're lucky. You can do a lot with an ATV. You can hook up a plow and move snow. Oh, that's another thing for moving and digging. Snow shovels. If you live in the Northern Hemisphere in any way, you should have a snow shovel, at least in your vehicle, if not in your home, on your deck, on your porch, in your shed, in your garage. Snow shovels. But you can also have a plow on your ATV. And a plow on the ATV allows you to move snow. It allows you to move wood chips. It allows you to push gravel around to level things out and build new things. There is like the T-Rex trailers that allow you to hook up with an ATV, and now you have a logging operation on the back that you have like a little winch system with a crane to help lift logs up. And you've got this, the classic U-frame kind of trailer that you see for logging. But you also have a ABS drum or tub that sets into that and bolts into that. So you can move gravel and mulch and wood chip and straw and manure. You can, the modern small scale homesteader, when I say small scale, I mean like sub 50 acres, doesn't really need a tractor if they have a good ATV with the right kind of equipment with it. Now, that being said, tractors, Peterbilt, John Deere, whatever, Mercedes-Benz, BMW, if you're over in the UK and other parts of Europe, although I guess the UK defines themselves as separate from Europe now. Whatever it may be, tractors are great to have if you require them. I don't require them. A lot of my neighbors have tractors, and when I've needed a tractor, I've been able to pay them to do the work for me. And that's mostly been regarding moving big things on the property. That's nothing to do with the actual garden. clearing land, anything like that. I've required them to move large wooden structures and large parts of the house that we're building with my off-grid home. Those are where I've required tractors, and I've paid them for those tasks. I don't need a tractor to manage a quarter acre of gardens and ducks. So I have no opinion on which one is the right one to have. If you need to get a tractor for your homestead, talk to your neighbors who use tractors and talk to several of them and ask a lot of advice and go and find out if there's a tractor course at your local college or agricultural depot and such. There may be places where you can learn to drive tractors and manage tractors and use tractors. And in where, depending on where you live, you may require a license to maneuver and manipulate and use a tractor. So keep that in mind. The final one for moving is a truck. Four-wheel drive, they don't have to be huge. The number one truck on almost any farm, anywhere in the world, and I do mean anywhere in the world, is the Toyota Tacoma or Hilux. Whether you're in British Columbia, Syria, United Kingdom, Australia, you're going to see Toyota Tacomas or Hiluxes. They are not a huge, they're not the Toyota Tundra, they're the Tacoma. They're the smaller model. Three of my very good friends who I do a lot of stuff with drive Toyota Tacomas, and they are unkillable trucks. Look at the old Top Gear episodes on YouTube talking about the Toyota Hilux. You'll see they are unkillable. You can do a lot of things with Toyota Tacomas. They are phenomenal. Or Hiluxes. If you're in different parts of the world, they're referred to as the Hilux. In other parts of the world, they're referred to as the Tacoma. Great truck. I grew up with a father that drove to Dodge Rams. My uncle drives a Dodge Ram. My cousin drives a Dodge Ram. 1500s can do most farm chores. Some people like their Chevys. Some people like their Fords. I'm not going to get into those debates. All I will say is, a good four-wheel drive pickup truck that doesn't have to be huge. It could be a Dodge Dakota. It could be a Dodge Dakota Sport, whatever you want. It can handle the majority of farm tasks, the majority of them. That's not all of them, but the majority of them. If you need a bigger truck, talk to neighbors who have bigger trucks. Be smart about it. If you can't afford a truck and all you have is a Subaru Forester or a Honda CR-V, make friends with with people who own trucks and use your vehicles to the best of their ability, to the full extent of their capabilities. When you come to their limitations, ask a friend. It's not that big of a deal. You don't have to own a truck to be a homesteader, okay? For many years now, we've gotten by with a Nissan Versa Note, moving 4 or 5 bales of straw at a time, the square bales, not the big round bales, moving all the kinds of crops and new trees and all that kind of stuff we've done almost exclusively for 3 years now with a Nissan Versa Note. And there's only been a handful of times where we were like, frig, I really wish I had a pickup truck for this. But when those moments happen, that's when you have friends who have pickup trucks and you talk to them and make arrangements with them to do that. And if you're on a small scale, like you're growing just a garden in your backyard or on your lawn, yeah, you don't really need a truck. You don't really need to. And I'm going to make it very clear. I do not consider myself a big scale homesteader. That's why we call our project the quarter acre homestead. It's the size of the average Canadian lawn. So that's why we call it that, because we're small scale. We're very small scale. We're growing 65 plus plant species. We've got, we have 31, including the 3 ducklings, but 28 adult waterfowl, and we're growing our entire, like, the goal is 80% of our food intake off of our garden. But that's kind of the point. We're doing it small scale, showing what you can do with small scale. If you want to go bigger, go bigger. Like, that's, I don't need a truck or a tractor. You might need a truck and a tractor, depending on what your situation is. I want to make that very clear. Then there's all the accoutrements of dump trailers, flatbed trailers, all the different tools you might have for a tractor for different tasks, different chores. All that kind of stuff comes with those machines. You got to figure that stuff out. with what you're doing and what you need and all that kind of stuff and where you may be going with it. So those are all the options for moving. There's a lot of other options for moving. Those are the main ones. There's always other things that can be brought into this. I'm sure somebody will be like, why don't you talk about this? Because I don't use it. And I haven't seen anybody using it around me. Therefore, I didn't consider it important. Okay, that's the main reason. If there's something that has been used around your communities for years and years and years, you're baffled that I didn't talk about it, email us, CanadianBushcraftPodcast@gmail.com. Email me, and I would love to look into it. Another aspect that I completely forgot about that just dawned on me when I finished that part of this episode's recording is another aspect of moving, is moving things across the land without other machines. And without a wheelbarrow, things that are heavy like logs, lumber, moving a building up and down, things like that. So you're going to want to look at jacks. Most of the time, you're going to want a bottle jack. I know you can get like car jacks and all those are great, but for the most part, if you need to move, like level a building that's big, like a homestead building of some sort, like a new shop or a new shed, and you got to level it or this setup, or you got to, you know, lift up the part of a tractor, bottle jacks, 20 ton bottle jack. They're not that expensive. They're like 100 something bucks max. I have the Motomaster ones. I've got four of them, and we were able to move a multi-ton, like 20 ton house, lift it up off its foundations, get the foundation out of the way, hook it up to a tractor, move it off the ground there, get it to a truck, move it across the province, and get it ready to move onto my property. And in a few days to a week, I'm going to be doing it again. We're going to be jacking it up, moving it down to my place, setting it onto the pad, jacking it up off the truck, and then setting down its foundation once more, all that kind of stuff, and the cribbing and all that kind of crap I got to do. So jacks, you're going to want jacks. Another thing you may want is some sort of winching tool. Now, you can always get away to a degree with the Kohansky flip-flop winch, which is two long poles and a heavy, stout, static line. You don't want to use dynamic line like paracord for it, but really at the end of the day, a good heavy duty, several thousand pound winch to drag logs, move a tree off the trail, drag a rock across the landscape, drag chunks of concrete, whatever it may be. But if you don't have the ability to have a winch, rope winches or come-alongs are worth their weight in gold. This could be everything from, a cow dies in the field and you don't have a truck that can haul it. You can drag it with a 200-foot rope hooked up to a stout fence post and then come along and drag it across to get it out of that field. Logs that are down, trees that are down, all you have is with your pickup truck or your ATV. And your ATV only has so much power to it. You can hook up a come along to a stout tree or stump and drag it. Pulling stumps out of the ground with a come along. All those kinds of things have to be considered. This is why I was like kind of laughing at myself at the beginning of this recording, because how could I possibly forgot this? Because I use these all the time. I just used my bottle jacks 4 days ago to help level a trailer for my neighbor. Like all that kind of stuff, moving things all over the landscape, moving things vertically, come-alongs, winches, jacks. These are things to think about. The classic scissor jack and all that stuff are great, but honestly, I truly suggest you invest in at least a couple of bottle jacks. They are so, so useful. So, so damn useful. So yeah, this is a little extra clip I'm just tucking in here before I finish the edits because, oh my gosh, I can't believe I forgot this. All right, on to the more, not esoteric, but not the same kind of tools that we're used to talking about so far. We've been talking about hard work hand tools. Let's talk about irrigation. Irrigation is the moving of water for different tasks, whether it's watering flowers, irrigating entire crops, or watering entire crops, fertigating, which is fertilizer irrigation, which is wet fertilizing, or simply filling up and topping up water troughs for your livestock. Or, you know, at the end of the day, moving water to wherever you need the water to be moved to. So that could be water for your household to a degree. That could be your well and all that kind of stuff. Put that in the category of irrigation as well, and plumbing. This could be looked at as like the water I use in my smithy for quenching and everything else like that. That can all be aspects of water and irrigation. There are basically five main categories, subcategories within the category of irrigation. The main one is hoses. And with this, I'm going to say keep it simple, stupid. KISS. 100% KISS. I'm sorry to anybody who thinks that they saw the coolest hose at their hardware store, big box store, neighbor's yard, whatever. You saw a cool, expanding, stretchy hose that's like the X hose, and it's black and it stretches out to 100 feet, but it's only actually like 15 feet. Yeah, I fell for those too. Or the ones that are, they lay flat like a fire hose and they roll up. Those are great too. I've seen those too. They all have cool aspects to them and they all have detriments. And in my experience, most of those detriments outweigh their benefits. The X hose, whatever it's called, that stretches out to 100 feet when it's only 15 feet when stored. Yeah. Hook that up to a sprinkler 100 feet away from your faucet. Just a tripod sprinkler or a little light sprinkler, hook it up. See how long your sprinkler stays at 100 feet before it gets dragged backwards back towards the faucet, because the whole thing is under tension the whole time. I've held that thing and tried to water, 80 feet away from my faucet, and had to fight it because it wants to go back to 15 feet. It's almost elastic. And on that, when you stretch out to 100 feet, tell me how the water pressure is, because now you've contracted and constricted the entire hose and barely any water is getting out to the end of it. Just buy a 100-foot long regular rubber garden hose. Yeah, they don't coil well. Yeah, they're heavy. Yeah, they're a pain in the butt. A, they're simple to use. B, there's hundreds of models of them and people, you can find them anywhere. C, man, I don't know where this little cough came from. C, if they get damaged, almost any hardware store has things you can fix them with, whether it's just new couplers or new hose heads or ends or fixtures, or if you actually cut it or damage it with like your machete or a lawnmower, what have you. You can trim off those two broken ends and put them back together with a hose coupler. There's so many different things that are made and designed for these simple hoses. Use the simple hoses. I cannot stress this enough. Unless you're using it for drinking water, stick to the simple hoses. For the drinking water, there's potable water safe hoses that are usually white with like a bluish gray kind of line on the side. Those are a different category altogether. Focusing on your garden and for everything else like that, keep it simple, stupid, okay? Or keep it stupidly simple, however you want to do that. Hose heads. There's the fan style and the variable setting, which looks like a pistol grip. And it's got all the different settings. You've got like cone versus jet versus fan versus vertical fan versus shower and all those different settings. You know what I don't use any of those settings when I just want the full pressure setting or the shower head setting. And even then, like, there's a lot of moving parts to it that can fail, especially when you got hard water buildup like I do. No, I'm not a fan of the variable setting. I like the simple fan one. If you check out like Skill Cult with Steve at Home on YouTube. What the heck is YouTube? Is that like the new social media way to inter bodies or something? YouTube. I mean, it's 3:30 in the morning while I'm recording this. So that could explain a few things. The fan one that he talks about, I have the same model. Mine's made of aluminum. Mine's cracked. And it's still better than the variable setting ones that everybody else uses. I love them. Love them, love them, love them. The fan setting or the fan style hose head. I can tilt it perfectly vertical and focus on one tree and get it good soaking, or I can hold it horizontal and spray an entire garden bed and get it all watered. That's great. Drip lines. That's a whole other thing that we can talk about, drip lines with timers and valves and all these different settings and soaker hoses that you can pick up to go around plants and trees and stuff. Those are all great as well. These are options we can totally look at when it comes down to hoses. But the fan style hose head, if you're looking for something to spray water with, keep it simple, stupid. I love that. I love the fan model instead of the variable setting pistol grip one. They're great. Watering cans. I have two opinions, and they're both right, and they're two very far ends of the spectrum. Get cheap, simple watering cans or a Haws watering can and nothing in between. The Haws-style watering cans are the big galvanized steel, have a long grip, and they have a long spout that comes up to the top to a flower that irrigates at a light pressure that's like rainfall, and they're like $250 Canadian. And they're hard to find usually. Most garden centers don't have them. Most hardware stores, I don't think any big box stores ever carried them. You've probably seen the little plastic Haws ones that are used for flowers on your porch. Same thing, but big and metal. And like $250. And they will last like decades, generations in the right situations, as long as they're well maintained. Keep them in a shed. Don't leave them out in the rain. Don't leave them out in the cold. Eventually they can rust. You can patch those rust holes. They're great. The Haws can last lifetimes. They're genuinely like a hand-me-down antique watering can that you can pass down for three or four generations and still make use of it. On the other hand, cheap plastic ones from the dollar store, most big box stores, will do most of the tasks you need. So if you want to invest for a lifelong watering can, the Haws models or the Haws design, and nothing else, in my opinion. I've not come across a watering can that can do that. I've used like $100, $200 watering cans at different people's places, and they almost all exclusively suck. They all either have too much pressure, not enough pressure. They're hard to hold on to. They're hard to reach the spot that you're trying to actually water. They just fail in one regard to another. The Haws does not fail. The Haws watering can. They're great. But a cheap, simple, like most of my watering that I do, whether it's in the grow boxes that we have out front of strawberries and lemon balm and herbs and all that stuff, or it's back in the garden, or it's at my Hugelkultur mounds covered in squash or whatever. A $5 watering can is doing most of it. And it's been doing it since I started the homestead 3 years ago. Can I really sit here and say, get a Haws? No. If you want something that can be passed down to your kids or your grandkids, or you're looking to be completely off grid and never coming back to buy more things, and you're going completely off into the wilderness to build your life in the Yukon or whatever it may be, yeah, sure, get a Haws watering can. They'll be perfect. Otherwise, cheap is fine. Watering can is a watering can. Don't buy expensive unless you're going to get a Haws, is what really I'm trying to say here. Buy cheap unless you want to get a Haws. Otherwise, just buy cheap. Sprinklers. There's a lot of options for sprinklers. You look online, you look in a garden section at a hardware store or a big box store. There's a lot of sprinklers. There's the tripods. There's the fan, which is the ones that we all remember as kids running through in our swimsuits that goes back and forth in a big fan and makes a little rainbow in the sky. And then there's the rotating head ones that have like one single post and they just spin. And like a like the classic watering sprinkler, water sprinkler, garden sprinkler that you know of, or lawn sprinkler. I like the tripods that have the rotating heads because they are fairly cheap, like $30-$40 max. And you can set them at different heights and you can set them in a position for a while and they're stable. You can actually like depending on... The one that I have just goes by the water pressure to move the head. Some of them may require a high pressure. So if you're using something like rain cisterns or rain barrels, they would have to be very high up on a hill to get enough pressure to get these things to move. But with most tripod ones, because they're nice and stable, they don't get knocked around, you can actually level them so that they have a weak pressure. They can still move from left to right and back to left fairly successfully with very low water pressure. If you don't have a rain system, that's like 50 feet above where your sprinkler is. If you're going fully off power, off grid, no power kind of thing. If you have a faucet with pressure from your wellhead and everything else, or from your town water, municipal water, whatever it may be, you can use pretty much any sprinkler you want. If you're trying to go off grid and you're trying to cut down on electrical use, you want a sprinkler that can work at low pressure, that can work at very low pressure and still do its job. They all need to be able to do a pretty decent spread. You don't want to have it get stuck in one spot and just soak down that one horseradish plant and drown it while everything else dies of dehydration while you're away for the day. You may want to set them up with the sprinkler with timers, or I've seen people talking about like setting up a sprinkler with like a water gauge so that when a certain point in the soil gets dry, the sprinklers turn on. All those kinds of things, or they come on at certain times. And when it comes down to watering, this is the last one on irrigation, specifically on the watering part. Then we're going to talk about the source of water in a moment. Where was I going with this for a second? Give me a second to think about this. You may want to consider, how can I say this? When you water. Some people will tell you middle of the day is fine. Probably not in the summertime, in my opinion, in most places at least. middle of the day, your water droplets become magnifying glasses. So if they're all over, you know, your corn leaves and your bean leaves and your azaleas and whatnot, those little magnifying glasses in the sun are going to cook your leaves and burn them. On the other side, other people say like water right after sunset. Sure. If you overwater, this is where fungal growth and molds and bacterias can actually start to wreak havoc on your plants and lead to root rot, lead to white molds and stuff like that growing on your plants because they don't get enough time of warmth to dry off. The best time of day to water, if you're going to set up a timer, is like an hour before sunrise, right there. If you've got to get up to commute every morning to work and, you know, you have, let's say, I work at 9, I live about an hour from work. Let's say I have to be at work at 8 to make this make more sense for the summertime. I have to commute to work. That means I have to be up at 7, out the door by 7. That means I have to be up around, you know, 6 to make sure I get brushed and cleaned up and coffee or whatever else I need done, breakfast, read the newspaper, or really just flip through social media feed. You know what? Make it 5:30 or 6, just before sunrise or just after sunrise, water your garden, turn on the sprinkler, whatever it may be, walk out there with your watering can, do that for a while while you wait for your coffee to percolate or your AeroPress to do its job, even though AeroPresses are waiting for the water to boil, let's go with that, or your coffee machine to do its thing. And of course, when coffee first comes out of a percolator, it's boiling hot, you can't drink it right away, give it like 5 minutes, walk outside, water the garden, then go on with your day. Now that your plants are well drunk, you can go off and do your things for the rest of the day and know that the garden's going to be okay. And this becomes your, you know, meditative time in the morning where you can go out and just enjoy the fact that you have a garden and you have a homestead and you're doing things, and then you get to go do this 9-to-5 drag that makes you hate your life. But then you get to go home and see that garden even more vibrant because you watered it that morning before it could get cooked and after it would have gotten root rot. You did it at the right time of day and you watered the whole thing. It's beautiful. You feel peaceful again. You feel at ease. You enjoy your dinner with your family or your cat named Stephen. And the next morning you get up groggy, turn on that coffee maker. You go, I got to go to work again. I should go stand in the garden for 15 minutes and water everything. He leaves Stephen in the bed. He meows at you, wishing you could stay in bed with him a little longer. And you go out to the garden. And you stand there in the glory before the sun fully rises. You're just out there and you can hear the birds singing. and a couple of mosquitoes nip you on the butt cheek. And Steven's yowling from the window, "Get back in here, meow," as you water the garden peacefully, meditative, feeling like Morihei Ueshiba, one of the creators and the main creator of Aikido. And Steven keeps screaming at you while the coffee is screaming as well inside that the coffee is ready, but it's too hot to drink. So you just keep watering as Steven screams at you. And then finally the mosquitoes bite you a little higher than your butt. And they get you on the lower back. And you're taking this as a moment of distraction during your meditation. You can focus more on that meditation because now you have distraction that helps you focus. And you're watering and you're watering. And the sun starts to creep up more. And Steven's getting more incessant. And now the coffee is smelling. You can smell it out in the garden because it's so well brewed. Now you go inside and you prepare for that day at that job that you hate so much to make food to feed Steven. So he can scream at you every morning. Stupid Steven. So that's your options of sprinklers and everything else like that. Beyond that, the number one thing we got to talk about is rain cisterns. And this is where things can get kind of controversial, kind of divisive, because there's certain places where you cannot collect rainwater for different reasons. And I don't fully grasp it, though I kind of understand it and begrudgingly accept it, I think is the best way to describe it. Where I live, we can collect all the rainwater we want. There is no restriction on rainwater, but that's because I live in the Great Lakes system. I live north of Lake Ontario, east of Lake Huron, southeast of Lake Superior, and all the other Great Lakes. I'm in the Great Lakes system. I'm surrounded by the Kawartha Lakes and Rice Lake and a bunch of rivers and tributaries and all that kind of stuff. I'm less than an hour drive from the St. Lawrence River, all that kind of stuff. All that beautiful, cool kind of stuff. A little bit more than an hour drive, actually, now I'm thinking about it, from the St. Lawrence. But I'm surrounded by water, so there's no need for people to be mad and restrict rainwater collection. Here, places like Arizona, Utah, other states, other countries where they restrict rainwater collection, that water needs to get back into the ecology to help the water table for everybody. So it kind of makes sense. I don't fully grasp it, but I'm not a hydrologist, and I don't work in deserts very much, so I don't fully grasp it, but I can understand it and I can appreciate it begrudgingly and be happy that I live in a place where I can collect rainwater. I've used big rain barrels and cisterns. I've used small rain barrels. The ones I have currently are about 35-40 gallon. Very happy with them for the garden so far. But that's because we've been getting decent rain this year. Last year, a lot less rain. Even this year, it's been spatters of rain, but they've been steady and give a good like misting shower over many hours to make sure the ground gets well saturated and stays wet for a couple of days under that mulch in the garden and the water dishes, and it recharges my well so I can fill up the duck pond again, which takes a lot of water, all that kind of stuff. But for the majority of my watering of plants, I'll use the rain barrels, and my rain barrels don't have lids on them. They don't have screens on them. And I want to make this very clear. They do get filled with mosquitoes. And because they're out in the sun, they do get algae in them. I have a solution for that. The solution requires some forethought, though, because this could become a problem for the ecology if you don't do it right. And that thing is goldfish. I go to the pet store and I buy feeder goldfish, not the regular goldfish that everybody like to have for their kids. And yay, they're so cute. And then they jump out of their water bowls or they eat the other one and explode because they ate too much and they die. And you're traumatized. And now you want to get a cat because at least cats live longer. Now you're stuck with Steven. Goldfish that I'm getting are feeder goldfish. These things are like 35 cents a fish. So I'm spending... for each rain barrel, I put 6 goldfish in it. I have 2 rain barrels, so I'm spending a little under $12, so like close to $10, maybe even less than that, maybe $7. If I actually did math, I could actually figure that out. But I buy them at the beginning of the season, and I let them swim in there, and they eat the algae, they eat the mosquito larva. I just have to make this very clear. I live within 100 meters of a major lake. And if these goldfish ever got out, they would become an ecological disaster, as they have been anywhere else they've escaped from human habitation. The difference is I have them in places where they're going to have to get through a lot of brush, a lot of materials, a lot of fencing, a lot of human landscaping, including ditches that are not connected to the wetlands or the waterways. Basically landlocked ditches, like in my yard where I have no drainage. It just stops at the road. And there's this berm that becomes the road. And then there's the next yard that gets all the way like 50 meters down to the lake. What we require to get these goldfish to swim out of these rain barrels and cross all of that landscape to get into the lake is astronomical amounts of rainfall. I would be having other issues other than goldfish escaping. In those moments where I know there's going to be heavy rainfall, I cover the rain barrels with a window screen. And that keeps them in. They can't escape. They can't swim away. And I'll put like a rock or a board of wood on there to keep it on. I'm just saying that I don't have professional lids for my rain barrels, because these are not the usual rain barrels. These are just 35-gallon or 40-gallon drums. I didn't get the ones that have the screw-on lids with the screen. You can get those kinds of things, and I could make a customized one out of some hardware cloth with a bungee cord to hold it on, all that kind of stuff. I could be using geofabric, whatever it may be, with a bungee cord or some parachute cord, I know. But all I do is, it's going to be raining today. I'll put this window screen, this spare window screen that's been sitting around for years, on top of my rain barrel. And that keeps my goldfish in. And then when I'm going to be gone for a few days and I don't know if it's going to rain or not, I just leave the window screen on. And this catches any asphalt from my shingles running off. This catches seeds and stuff from getting in there. Stops bullfrogs from jumping in and eating my goldfish. And at the end of the season, I can either put them in an aquarium here in my basement and grow a few things aquaponically with my, I'll grow sweet flag. I'll grow a few different kinds of plants. I'll even grow duckweed in my aquarium to filter out the nitrogen from the fish and that from their waste. And then I feed the duckweed to the ducks over the wintertime. And then in the next spring, I put them back in the rain barrels. As soon as the rain barrels are cleared of ice, I throw the goldfish in and they live in there again. Or since they cost me 35 cents each and they're feeder goldfish meant to be fed to piranhas and turtles and stuff, I'll throw them into the duck pond on the last week before it freezes. And the ducks get some extra protein before it gets much colder. It could be one or the other. I am not too hard up on saving these goldfish. As much as all life is sacred and all that kind of stuff, and I'm not saying that in a politicized manner as what's going on down in the States. If you follow our social media, I'm pretty sure you know where I stand on all that stuff. I'm saying that all living beings have a right to live. These goldfish were intended to be fed to turtles and piranhas and Oscar fish and Lord knows what other animals. If they live an entire year or an entire growing season off of algae and mosquitoes or mosquito larvae specifically, and I don't remember to get them into the aquarium before it freezes up, I'll just toss them in with my, or I don't have the aquarium set up, or maybe the aquarium broke or whatever. Maybe I was just a bad fish owner. I don't get too beat up about feeding them to the ducks. I feed worms from my compost to the ducks. No one gets angry at me when I say that. I'm like, oh yeah, when I'm ruffling through the compost and I see a couple big, fat, juicy earthworms, I just toss them into Mary Brown and Betty White, my Muscovy ducks, and they just gobble them up. Nobody ever gets mad about that. When you say you feed your rain barrel goldfish to the ducks, people get mad. So I just need to make that clear. Sometimes I save them and I keep them living for several years. And sometimes I say, screw it. Feed them to the ducks. I don't care. And all I'm trying to say is don't crucify me for saying it, okay? It's my fish. Dang it. They're my ducks. Dang it. It's my homestead. Dang it. It's what I'm going to do. So that's the last portion of our like irrigation conversation is the containers. They have to be food grade if you're going to be using them for drinking water or for feeding to your ducks. Or really, if you're going to be putting any of that water on your crops, if it was something that was holding some like diclostamine or some other weird chemical, don't use those barrels. You want to be using food grade barrels, rain cistern specific barrels, water specific barrels, food grade specific barrels, cisterns, things like that. Don't use things that held chemicals. Don't use things that used to hold bleach, because it'll still have some bleach in there, which is not bad at chlorinating a little bit of your drinking water, mildly, but it can be a problem when you're trying to water your compost to hydrate your compost that has to have a bunch of microbes in it to break everything down. And now you just added a bunch of chlorine. So that can be bad. a whole bunch of other things. The other benefit of having the goldfish in the rain barrels that I forgot to mention was they poop. And so when I scoop water out of those rain barrels with my cheap $4 watering can and go and water my Gediacosman squash or my flint corn or my sunflowers or my nasturtiums, there's going to be nitrogen and potassium and phosphorus in there from the fish's waste. And as the days go, the barrel gets shallower and shallower and shallower of water, and the water gets more and more concentrated nitrogen, and then it rains and tops it back up, and the fish have good diluted water again. And it starts all over, the system starts all over again. And I feed them maybe once a season. I'll bring some goldfish food out and sprinkle in because they've eaten all the algae and they've eaten all the mosquito larvae, and you can see that they're not getting a lot of food. I'll sprinkle like literally a quarter teaspoon of fish food into each one of the rain barrels, and the fish come racing up and eat it all up, and they're happy for days. And then in that time, since they haven't been eating a lot of the mosquitoes and they haven't been eating a lot of the algae, it grows back, the mosquitoes come back, and the cycle starts all over again. So rain cisterns, if you're going to be using rain cisterns, you need to have some sort of either head, which means it has to be up high. So if, let's say I have the rain cisterns on a roof at the top of my property and I have a, let's say, 30 degree incline, my garden must be below the top of the hill. Okay, so that my hoses and my sprinklers and everything else can water them from there. Otherwise, I'm going to need a pump, transfer pumps, sump pump, some sort of pump hooked up to these cisterns to move water uphill or across land. Okay, you can't just be on completely flat ground and just stick a hose in the top of your rain barrel and expect much to happen. You need to have some sort of pressure to move that water across land. Okay, so that's like the main thing I had to say there is think about how you're going to move water. That's a big part of this like challenge a lot of people have regarding homesteading is water. If they buy a property that is just a top of a hill and that's all they got, and there's no way they can afford to get a well drilled 400 feet down, and they don't have rain cisterns because they don't have any structures built, and they're not hooked up to the municipal water, how are they going to water everything? You got to figure that stuff out. Almost a year before you actually start building everything, you got to figure that out. What are you going to do for water? How are you going to do water? I've got a lot of friends who live in this region who do homesteading, who have gardens, who do market gardening even. They go to the point where they're selling at farmers markets, and they're always fighting for water. They're always fighting for irrigation. So think about that stuff long before you actually execute your plan. I think that's all I had to say about this. And so that's the end of this episode. We've talked about our cutting tools, our digging tools, our moving tools, and our irrigation tools for our homestead. This is going to be part of a series of Tools of the Trade episodes. The first one was episode 79 back in August of 2021. If you want to check that one episode out, it's episode 79 from August 2021, one of our very first years, our second season of the podcast. Now we're in our third. And so I figured let's jump back, look at some of these old episodes and see where we can build some series to help you kind of explore other aspects, other options. We've done a lot of our 101 episodes now. We've covered like most of the Bushcraft 101 kind of stuff of water, shelter, fire, tools, safety, navigation, camping, all that kind of stuff. We haven't done a navigation episode yet. I'm looking for a really good talk with someone to interview to talk about that. So I've got a few people on navigation I'm going to consider. We're going to get that going soon. But this is one of those series where we're going to be diving deeper into like leadership. We want to talk about some amazing leaders and amazing explorers and survivors of different situations, case studies that we've done in the past, like Shackleton and the Alert plane crash and everything else. And all that. This is just one of those kinds of series. We're going to be starting to dive deeper into these conversations, deeper into these philosophies, deeper into these theories, deeper into these thoughts and considerations. So I figured a good one to start off with, to kick us off with, was the tools of the trade. So this is our homesteading episode. There'll be another one coming up next week that will be another tools of the trade, which will be announced later of what this the next episode will be about. And that's it. This is the end of the episode. I want to thank all of you for making it as far as you have with me on this episode. I want to thank every single one of you dear listeners. You bring a lot to the table for us. You support us in so many different ways, especially those of you who are on Patreon. Those patrons we have on Patreon help keep the lights on here at the podcast, the homestead. They're helping us cover the expenses of doing everything we do. All the way to keeping the dog fed and the ducks fed so that they don't, you know, revolt against us and start eating us. So that's really important that all those people exist over on Patreon. People like Nelson, Martin, Renee, Paul, Nikki, these amazing folks who keep us moving forward. And we try to give as many kickbacks as we can to them. We've been a little lacking on that in May, sadly, because of what happened at the loss of my father in this past June, trying to just catch back up and get everything done we can. And now we're into July. So we're going to be doing a lot more kickbacks for those folks. If you're at the upper tiers, we have virtual learning classes where we're doing specific skill by skills that we call the Patreon Virtual Bushcraft Skills Course each month. We have garden tours that happen, virtual garden tours, virtual tea, basically campfires we call, where everybody of all tiers can get together and talk. All these different kinds of things are happening over on patreon.com/Canadian Bushcraft. If you're not a patron, get on over there. It can cost as little as one coffee a month, like those old ads or infomercials that used to be on in between our cartoons as kids. Check us out. Support us over there so we can support you back. Thank you so much for watching this or listening to this podcast. Hope you enjoy the next one as well. We'll see you later. Tread softly.